We're talking about investigations, about politics, the Chicago outfit, and that nexus between politics and crime. Rob Grant is here for a second part of this two-part series. The former special agent in charge of the Chicago office of the FBI worked on terrorism cases that you're going to hear about. A Chicago case involving a lawyer who was directing attacks and murderous attacks in Mumbai. These are the things that fall on the cutting room floor in most news stories. This is important to me. And also, he's going to talk about that federal investigation in Illinois. Joining me as always is my friend, Jeff Carlin, executive producer of the Rokan Show on WGN. And me, I'm John Cass. I'm a husband, I'm a father. I'm a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and I'm a member of its editorial board. And I'm looking forward to Christmas. And here's the second gift to you on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
You don't want to say a word to me, you don't have to say anything to me. I don't really give a 25 years, pal, that's what you're going to do. And see how much of a good guy you're going to be then.
All day I thought the guys in the helicopter were just local cops busting my balls over Lufthansa. They turned out to be narcs. They've been on me a month. Phone taps, surveillance, everything.
Bye-bye, dickhead.
The old Chicago way must give way to the new reality.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
You like what you hear? Well, then you know what to do. Find us on iTunes, subscribe, tell your friends, write us kick-ass reviews of 5 stars or more. I don't think you can go over 5. No one will take you to Chinatown for spaghetti dinner at midnight, but we will always thank you for it. So we're talking to Rob Grant, FBI special agent in charge in Chicago for many, many years. He was the boss of the FBI here at the end of the family secrets trial.
Yeah, actually, yes.
Right?
Yes.
With Mitch Marsh, your mm-hmm. people, you had Mitch. Great people working there.
God bless him.
Yeah, God bless him. One of the great closing arguments I've ever heard.
And he was sick at the time.
Yeah.
It's amazing he had the resolution to go in there and do what he'd committed to all his life and carry off such a great, great end of that prosecution.
In my, there's a secret about that I guess I can share now because it's, you know, it's late now, so I'll have to go look myself in the files. Before the indictments, I had sources tell me that there was a guy being driven around Chicago. They were going to parking lots looking for holes where people may have been buried.
Who is that source?
I'm not going to tell you. But it came out to me that that it was there, and I started Matt Wahlberg, who's now no longer with the Tribune, my leg man at the time, and I ended up drove all over the city and county from Chicago Heights all the way up north talking to people. I remember talking to the FBI about it. I don't know if you were the special agent in charge at the time, but I was asked, if you go with this story right now, you could blow the whole case. We haven't even wrapped it up yet. And little did I know that at that time, and this is really a sad story, a former marshal, deputy marshal.
He was a supervisory U.S. marshal.
Oh, supervising U.S. marshal.
Ran the Fugitive Task Force here in Illinois.
Had been talking about this to a guy who his dad did time with, the marshal's dad did time. He was a former police officer, did time in the Market 10. The other guy did time. and he was talking about it, and that was getting to the, let's say, the guys who know about not going to for spaghetti dinner at midnight, if someone asks you, those guys. And I got this information, and FBI asked me to hold on. I mean, I wanted a great story. I didn't want to kill the case, because I've always wondered about the media and law enforcement. I've seen other cases that get blown up, federal cases, when it's not finished by media. And it's usually a leak, and you have to figure out why that leak is coming. Some people say, and I have friends who go, just go with the story, whatever you have. I'm not going to operate that way. I don't want to be played by some other side for like a second, you know, false flag recruitment type of thing, and you don't even know how you're being used. So I didn't run it, and later I did. The FBI was accused of leaking it to me in a book by a colleague, but that didn't happen. I explained to myself to the colleague afterward, no, it wasn't the FBI. It wasn't the Boy Scouts. It was the anti-Boy Scouts. That case, Family Secrets, was so significant. Can you tell us why you think it was significant?
Yeah, it was significant because we solved, although we charged, I forgot the number of murders, I think it was 18 in the case, we solved over 30, and prior to that, no mob murder had ever been solved and charged. So it finally sort of put a finger on the leadership of the outfit here in Chicago for the brutality of their organization, the corruption of their organization, their influence, and it's waned, obviously.
Since then, it was a death blow.
Yeah, and so it took away that myth that, you know, you can't touch the outfit, and it held a lot of senior people accountable for a lot of years of activity here in the Chicagoland area. So
one just died.
Yeah,
Mr. Goldstein. I'm sorry, Joey Lombardo, but he said he was Mr. Goldstein to me.
Died a ham sandwich. So it's, I think it was significant in that it sometimes piercing the myth, and it's the same thing we talk about the brand of the FBI and the brand of the CIA. You know, it works for you. Some people will talk to the FBI because of their impressions of the FBI.
Right.
And, you know, you got to be held accountable for what you do ultimately. But you want that brand to work for you. You want people to trust when they come to the FBI. Watergate was a classic example of the case agent for Watergate. I think he's out in San Francisco. I think he's still alive. He talked about how he had everything Woodward and Bernstein made the name on and wrote their books on and became fabulously wealthy was all derived from FBI agents' work. So the FBI agents were driving that investigation. And every one of their FD-302s was showing up in the paper the next day because there was an FBI official who was leaking it.
Mark Fult.
Correct. And so they were frustrated because they actually went to people who were scared to death and said, I'll talk to you because you're the FBI and you've promised me some confidentiality. And then they read it in the paper within 2 days. And then they're calling back saying, wait a minute, I agreed to talk to you. I agreed to help, but I did not expect to see my name in the paper.
Right.
So all that work was really just reporting on a leak coming out of the FBI on the work of FBI agents who are driving towards the White House. And the ultimate tape that gets covered up here is President Nixon and it's either Ehrlichman or Haldeman. They're in their office, and they can't stop the FBI from doing what it's doing. It gets closer and closer to the White House. It's getting closer and closer to creep. It's not being impeded. So that's when they fashion the national security story to have the agency come to the FBI and say, this is a national security matter, you've got to stop. So that's the smoking gun tape of conspiracy to obstruct. And it was the FBI just doing what the FBI does, follow the facts where they may lead you, follow the facts to people who are scared because they're in Washington, D.C., their whole life is politics, very powerful administration,
yes.
Very powerful. So there's always a tension there when somebody leaks something a little too soon. Abscam, you probably remember Abscam, which is the bribery of...
Sure, that was the congressman.
Congressman and one senator. Well, there was a long list of people who were ready to take those bribes. That got leaked prematurely.
Do you ever think that it was leaked prematurely for a reason?
Yeah, I think there were people in the FBI who began to question whether or not tremendous damage would be done to the country. It's like an auditor takes it and says, let's do a sample. The sample will have the same effect, and we won't have a constitutional crisis if we end up, you know, bribing every member of Congress and every senator up there. I'm not going to say they were all corrupt, but there definitely were more targets who were in line to come to meet with the Arabs to take their payoffs, and it got truncated. Now, I don't know the full story about whether it was deliberately leaked by the Bureau to bring it to an end, deliberately leaked by Department of Justice to bring it to an end, but there definitely was concerns about the depth of where that went. And that, of course, classic Congress, oh, my God, the FBI actually investigates us. Let's stop that.
Right.
So every time the FBI gets close to Congress, they react to defend their own institution. You remember the Congressman Jefferson in Louisiana?
When, sure, the $90,000 in the freezer.
Yeah, the pizza.
Just like Jimmy DeLeo Jimmy DeLeo only had $35,000 in his freezer.
Congress reacted very badly to that.
Yeah.
And threatened the FBI for conducting an investigation of a member of Congress. Now, it was a classic case of bribery, cash stuffed in their freezer. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up in Hollywood.
And his congressional office.
And his congressional office. And at that time, the Republicans had control of the House. I don't know if they had the Senate at the time. President Bush was in there. But they went bonkers about why you didn't let us know about your investigation.
Uh-huh.
And that impacted everybody around the country, because after that case, after Congress kind of threatened the Bureau, anytime we had a member of Congress that we wanted to interview, we kind of had to let them know. And that impacted us here in Chicago, and I'm sure it impacted other people. So there's a lot of risk attached to getting close to members of Congress. The FBI has done it and done it successfully, but there's always a price to pay. And that's what the public has to kind of keep an eye on, Congress always institutionalizing and protecting itself at the expense of maybe law and order.
They talk about health care, but they have the best.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what can you say?
Yeah.
And I'm not going to ask you about other leaks that may have or not have stopped investigations in Chicago.
No.
Although I still want to know, when we're old, men, we're not old yet, but when we're old, someday we'll be sitting on a park bench and I'll be having a cigar and you'll be doing push-ups or whatever you do, and I'm going to say the name John Wyma.
I'm not going to comment on names. I will tell you this. After I retired and I left a document in my safe and there was no electronic record, the only thing in the electronic record keeping of the FBI was a reference to an interview, and it was signed out only to be found in the FBI SAC safe. And one of the guys that followed me opened the safe, found it, called me, and said, "Oh my God!" I said, "Yep." So those are the things that never reach the light of day that the FBI sometimes knows about, because of the person of interest, it was one of those things that we did not want to have in the hands of the general workforce for fear that it would create a problem.
We just have to tell the listener, and we'll move on. But I have to tell the listeners, in case you don't know, John Wyma worked for Rod Blagojevich, and this is why it's a sensitive story for me, because the Tribune broke a story that John Wyma was wired, and that killed or stopped the investigation, because then Rod Blagojevich was on phones talking like a Boy Scout right after that, and Jesse Jackson Jr., who was wanting to become a senator, and people that wanted to donate to Rod, everything stopped. But, well, and I know you can't have that conversation now, but someday I'm going to want to read that paper.
That's when I'll have that convenient Alzheimer excuse that all the organized crime guys have right before they go into trial.
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah,
nothing.
I forgot. I don't remember anything past yesterday.
Speaking of Illinois, there's a major federal investigation going on. And we talked about this at the Lincoln Forum. Jeff, do you think that federal bus will keep rolling?
I think it's got a full tank of gas, if that's to be to believe, for sure.
Well, what do you want to know from the former special agent in charge on how investigations are run?
Well, so I've got this, you know, this fantasy in my head that there's a room, and we always joke about this because it's Hollywood, like you say, you've got that facade that the FBI has, that there's a room in Chicago where it's just like thread going to photos of countless politicians, countless lobbyists, and that everyone's like, okay, well, we need to get this thread to that thread, and that's what we're working on. And we know that this is a thing, and that this thread, we got to find the thread that goes to here. And it seems like in recent times that those threads are all coming together. Is this a really a hot time for activity in the FBI in Chicago, or is it always super active? It's just those threads just don't come together.
They don't always come together. Sometimes there's an interest like the FBI might understand how it's working, but doesn't have the credible evidence to move in the direction it wants to move. So it's always collecting, adding to that, you know, information base. And there might be a room with diagrams of people, phone calls. That's what intelligence analysts do. And then you start figuring out a strategy with the prosecutors. You have a very good U.S. attorney here in John Lausch. You got a good history of a commitment to investigate corruption, no matter where it may lead here in Illinois. I can tell you, if for your listeners that are not from Illinois, that's not the same everywhere. There's politics in different places. But here, it's always been an institutional high priority of the U.S. Attorney's Office, priority of the FBI. And fortunately, the juries here are good, and they don't want to tolerate corruption, although they seem to live in it day in and day out. But when you finally bring somebody up to account, the juries tend to be receptive to that evidence. They don't just basically turn a blind eye and let them off. So, yeah, that's probably going on. Now, how much of this is driven by a strategy? How much is it driven by opportunity? And how much of this is driven by the effort to preserve things that might otherwise disappear in the night? I can't tell you. I don't have that kind of insight. And I deliberately don't ask the people like the Brendan O'Learys and the Ted McNamaras who are some of the best out there working this field. So
yeah, he referenced his old crew, which is the Public Corruption Task Force in the FBI, one of the best in the country, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Most experienced with people. Teddy McNamara, who's now, I think, retired. Is he? I hope he's not.
I don't know if Ted's retired or not. He was on the affidavit for...
Panhart.
And also Burke.
Burke, yes.
So he had moved from Oregon. When I retired, I had recommended, and Brendan O'Leary had become a supervisor. Brendan was one of those classic situations where he's a 400 hitter as an agent. Do you really want to put him behind a desk? And that's always a tension spot. Mm-hmm. The guy who's driving your cases, do you want to put him in a leadership role? And we decided that he had earned it. But I guarantee you, he's out there in this space because he's very good.
That's right here.
And Ted McNamara took over and became a supervisor while I was there, and then There's a cap on serving as a supervisor in the FBI, so you can only serve 7 years, and you have to step down or get promoted.
But if you get promoted, you have to leave town.
That's correct.
And what if you have, like, a family and kids? And that's why I think some of the FBI rules are a little crazy. You need institutional memory. Like, we've got kids at the paper. They don't know who Mike Tatum is. They don't know... You know, Michael Vondra, and it's all coming up now. I mean, the experienced guys like Jason Meisner, Ray Long, they know, you know, but some don't. And you have to have that institutional memory. Or
when I had a very good FBI agent retire, you know, they can't run the mile and a half like they used to. They can't do quite as many push-ups, and maybe they've been to the bar one or too many times.
Yeah.
We're not missing the muscle. We can always find muscle, so to speak. But that institutional knowledge, that the transfer of that institutional knowledge to a younger generation is a very hard thing to capture. And that's what you lose. You lose a veteran agent who goes out the door, retires, and that network, the fact that they can get to information so much faster than a younger agent, only because they've been around the block and they know everybody. That's the big loss. The cap on service has always been on the Bureau's books, but it wasn't implemented until Bob Mueller became director. And it was originally 5 years, and we talked to him and said, you know, you can't do this.
Yeah.
It's going to destroy this very issue of institutional memory. So the transfer issue is always an issue in the FBI. When Louis Freeh was director, he did away with the rotational transfers. And because he was family friendly, he had come into the FBI from an FBI agent's perspective. But what he didn't understand is the institutional problems it created. So I'm sitting before Bob Mueller, briefing him on an inspection of a field office where we had a national security threat, a huge national security threat, all focused on a major classified project for the Department of Defense. And lo and behold, all around that small little office, suddenly Chinese students show up. Chinese students are going to school there. Chinese companies are starting to appear. And it doesn't take a rocket science to figure out what's actually going on here.
Right.
There's a collection effort going on in that area.
Right.
So then we looked and said, all right, who do we have down here who's got experience in these matters? And we said, well, after 10 years of no transfers, nobody in this office has ever served anywhere but this office. They've never been up against a serious national security threat. And so this conversation with Bob Mueller, we sort of gave the history of the transfers, you know, is to make people happy, not transfer them around. But it comes at a cost, and that cost is the fabric that is the FBI, that cross-pollination of people who have different experiences from different offices, different environments, large offices, small offices, national security places where they're
critical.
Critics. And it isn't lost on the bad guys. So when I came here, after the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet Union collapsed, you know, Clinton administration and the Congress being the purveyors of let's fix the budget. We don't have to support national security anymore. So almost all the national security efforts that the FBI had in the United States disappeared.
You win the Cold War and then forget it. Now we're going to spend it on patronage.
So what happened is the Russians figured it out. So as soon as Putin takes over power, he starts expanding the Russian intelligence apparatus in the United States to levels way beyond what it had been in the Cold War. And what we found out is the Russians were doing their meetings in the offices where the FBI did not have a dedicated counterintelligence program. They knew. They knew that to operate in Washington, D.C. or New York City, where we had retained a capability, was higher risk than meeting in Chicago, where we had not the capability.
They'd go up to Niles and
in one
of those nightclubs with the red plush seats.
Yeah. Right.
I'm not going to say.
Vlad the Enforcer shows up. No,
right,
but the reality is, you know, our adversaries are always looking at what we're doing in this space, and they're looking at how they meet their sources, and let's find a less risky spot where we might not get detected.
Sure.
So if you're in Washington, D.C., where you have a very robust national security enterprise, it's a little bit higher risk than going to Niles, Illinois.
It's kind of like if you're going to be the outfit, you're not going to meet in an Italian restaurant with checkered tablecloths and Chianti candles. You're going to go to Brown's Fried Chicken.
Or you're going to walk down the street like John Gotti and Sammy the Bull did and said, hey, there.
That's a great story. Tell that story about the microphones.
So organized crime in New York City, the Gambino crime family, they all assume that their houses are bugged, their phones are bugged, their private clubs are bugged. So they learned the discipline of using coded language when they talk. And so part of the trick in the FBI is to figure out what the code is,
right,
break the code, and then map it to what you've collected to say, this is what this means, you know. But the other piece is, you know, where are they having the real conversations? Where do you really want the bugs? Because they're obviously sensitive to the fact that they're always under investigation. So there was a, you know, surveillance on John Gotti and Sammy the Bull revealed that they were constantly walking outside his club and walking down the street, having these one-on-one conversations. It suddenly came to realize that's where the conversation's taking place. Like, let's take a walk. You know, let's take a walk, Sammy. So the parking meters were all out there, so we decided to bug all the parking meters. So we captured their conversations as they walked down the street, and that's what broke the case on John Gotti and Sammy the Bull, who flipped and became a government witness. So, you know, people who are surveillance conscious, like spies and organized crime members, they speak in code. They have discipline. When they break discipline, that's when you have an opportunity to get in there. And then surveillance is always looking for where is the place where you can actually collect something.
Hello.
Listen, I got to meet Clean Face right away. What about the Shea Paree?
No, you can't. You got to make a reservation. It's all booked up.
No, it's okay.
It's impossible. It's booked up, and you got to make a reservation. It's very difficult to get in.
No, it's okay. I'll use the service entrance. I'll see you at 9.
All right.
And it's not just organized crime. Many politicians in this fine state talk in code and work in code, and as we're learning,
reporters too.
Yeah, reporters too.
But say you have that. Speaking of Jeff's point, you have that tape, you have that video of some kind of illegal action or thought to be illegal action, and then the federal bus pulls up, and Rico's driving it, and you invite the guy on your bus, and you press the button. And he hears it, or she, mostly he, they hear it about, let's say, I love Asian girls, or Viagra, or
little boys,
tunas, or
whatever they like, right? And they hear that. What is it like to be the agent in the room watching this person confronted with that thing, whatever it is? I'm not saying anything specifically. But whatever it is that's revealed, when they realize they're caught, this is it. They got
when the FBI shows its hand,
right?
Well, this may surprise you. There's a lot of empathy, understanding what they're going through emotionally, physiologically. You know, it's when you get a standard practice in the FBI is when you get a corrupt police officer, you know that in their community and their loved ones, their family, their neighbors, they're known as the police officer. When we know that they're a corrupt police officer, that whole facade of their world is going to come crumbling down, because you don't recover from being called a corrupt police officer.
I mean,
everything you've built in your entire life is crumbling down. So you're probably thinking about, how are my kids going to think about me? How's my wife going to think about me? What about my mom and dad? So there's a lot of empathy with them and understanding what they're going through.
Because a good investigator or a good reporter is an empathetic personality that can, because you're trying to find out, and you can't find out by cruelly laughing at that person when they're in that time of need.
It's interesting you bring that up. So you're exactly right. Being empathetic in that process. You know, you've got to be objective, but you've got to be empathetic and understand, you know, these are all people that made mistakes in their lives,
right,
and took the dark path. But now they're real human beings, their lives could come crushing down. And so you're sympathetic to that. It was a tension point between the FBI and the military and CIA down in Gitmo post 9/11, because the FBI is much like a good detective. It's, you know, you get more by being patient and empathetic and work that piece. It takes longer to get the information that you're really after, but showing that you care about somebody builds some semblance of trust, helps bond with the person that's confessing their life story and knows they're going to maybe go into prison for the rest of their life. And down in Gitmo, there was harsh interrogation techniques, and the FBI had a great conflict with the CIA and the FBI over this very issue, saying your techniques are not effective. Your techniques are born out of something you watched on TV, and you haven't been doing this like we've been doing it for 100 years. You do it only in battlefield conditions. But the temperament of, say, for example, the military is, I want to know what's actionable right now, what's a threat to my...
To my guys right now.
Yeah, so there's a desire to be intense.
Mm-hmm.
When we interrogated David Headley here in Chicago, it was the empathetic approach that we employed.
Which one was he?
David Headley is the one who the attacks in Mumbai, the terrorist attacks.
Oh, yes.
2008.
Right.
He was based here, and he was the eyes and the scouting and the operative that gave them all the targets, told them how to land, where to go, gave them the GPS coordinates of all the locations, because the people that were training to do the attack were all in Pakistan. They'd never been in India. So they didn't have any people on the ground to basically walk around and say, that's the hotel, that's the Chabad house, that's the whatever. And oh, by the way, we're going to land them on a boat. Well, where do we land them? Well, David was the one that set up a false company in India as a facade to go in there and pretend he was doing business, but he was really collecting on behalf of this terrorist organization.
Which one?
It's a terrorist organization out of Pakistan that's used as, you know, some countries use indirect methods to attack their adversaries.
Sure.
And it's always been accused that this group has been the group that the Pakistanis have used to attack India.
Got it.
So therefore, they have deniability as a country. We weren't behind this, and we don't start a nuclear war. But that's how this was done. So David, based out of Chicago, using the front as a law office, went into Mumbai, scouted all these locations, gave them the plans, and then told them where to land to get into Mumbai secretly by water and start their attacks.
A Chicagoan.
Yeah. And we didn't do a press conference at the time. It's probably one of the biggest cases that's ever been in the Chicago district. Because the Obama administration had come in immediately before that, and they had the impression that too much was being made about terrorism, so they did not allow Pat and myself to do any kind of press conference.
Wow.
But it was probably one of the most revealing and interesting aspects, that instead of the United States being attacked, the United States was being used as a platform to attack another place. And behind that was the facade that we were still hunting for bin Laden. Bin Laden wanted conflict between Pakistan and India.
Sure.
Because it would draw Pakistani forces away from Waziristan, which is where he was believed to be.
Right.
So he was in favor of trying to foment some sort of discontent between the two countries.
That's amazing that a guy in office here is getting involved in something way across the world. That was such a
what was his motivation?
Thing.
Well, he had
was his real name David Headley, or was it that?
Yeah, he's in prison for the rest of his life here in the United States.
Probably in Supermax in Colorado, down below the ground.
I know where he was when I left. I don't know where he is today, but he's probably in the same place.
Right.
But he had been using an immigration law office run by Tarur Rana, and that he was an operative out of that law office. And both men were charged. David Headley was convicted. He actually pled. He was, David was Pakistani. He had been in a Pakistani military school growing up. So he looked at himself. In fact, when we did the secret arrest, as we like to say, we let him get on a plane and board a plane. He was heading overseas to do another attack, actually. And we realized we couldn't allow him to go down that path. So we had to bring him in. And so we let him electronically board the plane. So anybody who might be looking for him would realize, hey, he got on the plane. Where is he now? So we brought him down here and began to talk to him. But the team that we put in there to interview him, one was an FBI agent who had been in the military, and then another one was a young agent who really was the case agent on the case that had really put this thing together and done a great job. But we knew that in front of David, his view of the world was he was a soldier operating on behalf of Pakistan. That was how he viewed himself. He didn't think of himself as a terrorist. He thought of himself as a soldier fighting for Pakistan.
Right.
So we wanted to build a rapport between the interrogators and him. And so for, you know, over time, he developed a rapport with my agent who had a military background. And that's how we arranged to do the interview, was to build that, you know, instead of condemning him for being a terrorist.
Right.
Why did you do this? And what was interesting was he had a lot of contacts overseas. He'd been to a lot of places the agency wanted to know about. So my office was filled with intelligence personnel, just pumping him with questions day in and day out. And
your guy or your agent, man or woman, did they feel protective of him? Like they were like you're trying to get information out of him for your purposes. CIA, DIA, everybody else wants other stuff. So how do you, like, when I have other reporters wanting to talk to my sources, which I never do because I don't have any, and I just tell them I don't have any.
Well, the vehicle was through the agents. So they were in the background with Pat, myself, and everybody else. So they would, you know.
Oh, okay, so they would ask on their behalf.
You might end up talking about pizza, the best pizza places in sure. Chicago for half an hour, but that patience, it's called leakage. The longer you have with somebody who is talking, the more likely they're going to become comfortable, and they're going to start, their natural defenses of giving up information start to deteriorate, and they start to let things out.
There's a talent to that, right? And
yeah.
Do you know it when, as an FBI supervisor, do you know it? Can you see it in young agents and nurture that? Or is it something that some can go through the door hard, right? Some people can go through the door really hard, and react really quickly. And other people don't react quickly, but they have that talent, or they can think three moves ahead. Right?
There, it's as much, you can train only so much.
Right.
But some agents are particularly good at it, and you know who they are.
They show themselves.
Yeah,
right,
and some of them are, you know, it's like any other organization. Right. Some people are better at it than others. Those are the 400 hitters. Those are the Ted McNamara's, the Brendan O'Leary's.
Sure.
You know, things like that. And then there's others you say, you know, having that person in the background is probably a good idea, you know.
I have to ask you about this federal case before we go, because I could talk to you for literally for hours. This federal case now, we've got, it looks like the FBI is drawing a circle around Mike Madigan. It looks like to me, after what I'm reading in the press, I'm going to be like my friend in the State Department. All I'm seeing is what I'm reading in the press, is that there was a move from, in terms of this organization that, let's call it Madigan, there's a move from politically dominated moves, discussions, like from politicians to lobbyists. I'm seeing that the apparatus moves where lobbyists are now key players as opposed to just functionaries. And they're the ones driving for him. How do you see this thing going?
Well, John, I have no insight as to the current investigation,
I only know what I
read in the paper, but I do see there's opportunities there for the FBI to do what it's always done, and that is find the weak links in the armor. You know, people who are very successful in being involved in corruption or organized crime or drug dealing insulate themselves with trusted individuals, and the further out you go, you get, you know, more opportunities. The key is what's the vector in to the inner circle? And these might be opportunities to get vectored into the inner circle. I can't speak to Michael Madigan or anything like that. I can say is people who are lobbyists, they all have a life, and they've probably never done anything wrong in their lives that they thought was wrong.
Right.
But when you confront them with the reality of what they've done, sometimes that can be a transforming opportunity for an interview for somebody to say, okay, let me tell you what I've really done. I think I mentioned to you when they had Silver Shovel here in Chicago, one that was leaked early.
Right. That's the one I was referring to that really pissed me off because it was leaked and I knew you guys were going farther up the chain and you couldn't.
We couldn't. But in that case,
it was called a big scoop. But really, I thought, man, Daly's got to be happy here.
Yeah, it gets truncated. So, but in that case, the principal source in that was actually the subject of a bank fraud investigation on the Financial Crime Squad by Tony D'Angelo. And once Tony D'Angelo had him and got him in the room and said, let me show you your history, and he goes, okay, you got me.
John Christopher.
Yeah. And John Christopher then says, you know, he's throwing out his ace in the hole. You got me for that. But let me tell you about the rest of my story. And Tony D'Angelo was a very good agent, was smart enough to say, this is an opportunity into some corrupt behavior here in the city of Chicago. So he walked him over to Roy Lane's squad. Roy was the supervisor of the corruption squad at the time and said, with Jim Davis, said, hey, I think you might want to talk to Mr. Christopher. So before we complete his charging and sentencing over here, let's utilize him as far as we can. And from that was developed the undercover operation that was Silver Shovel. So sometimes vectors by which you get into places come from unusual places. There's a conversation I think I mentioned to you when I was talking to Bob Mueller is you can't like focus the FBI strictly on organized crime and terrorism. It's the fabric and the variety. It's the principal investigative arm of the Department of Justice, period. And it's that fabric that makes it very effective. You know, it may come out of a healthcare fraud case. It may come out of a financial crimes case. You never know where these opportunities are going to arise, and you want to capitalize on when they do.
But clearly we're seeing this is no longer, and I know you didn't personally like just grabbing low-hanging fruit. I know that. I know that many of the, I don't know the agents on the working on public corruption, but I would assume they're like that. And this is not about low-hanging fruit, as we just from reading the press, reading the Tribune, is it?
My guess would be it's not, but I don't know. And low-hanging fruit, you can't walk past it. You know, if it's a bad apple, you got to do it. I used to get that question on terrorism. Isn't this guy kind of stupid, or is this? Yeah. Somebody took cash in their alderman office. Well, you know, you can't like walk away from it. You've got a crime that's in front of you. You got to finish it off. The only issue was you don't want to be spending all your time doing the low hanging fruit and forget the bigger apples in the tree and the more complex investigations. And that's one of the great things I loved about the FBI was a big office like Chicago can be patient and spend a lot of time really working deep into the architecture of a criminal enterprise and collect information. Maybe, as we found in Family Secrets, some of that information went back to the late 60s.
Right.
So ultimately, you're going to act upon that information. You don't know when, but you're collecting. And when the time comes.
Well, the time has come for us. But I wonder, now that you're here in Chicago, the Chicago area, would you come back?
Yeah, if I have something of value to say, I'm happy to help any way I can.
It's just fascinating. To me, as a reporter, I'm just fascinated to hear how this stuff works. I mean, it's not that you're giving opinion, you're not being bombastic about it, you're just explaining how the thing works. And I'm just fascinated. So thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for doing what you do, and thank all those reporters that still go out there and work every day trying to uncover this stuff, because it's valuable.
Thanks, Rob.
You're welcome.
So thanks, Rob Grant, for being here. I'm fascinated by all this stuff. It is like pulling the veil. The FBI has troubles now with the Horowitz report, with Durham investigating, but to hear a professional like this, and there are so many, and he mentioned a few, Brendan Leary, Ted McNamara, and many others. And to see them do their work is just, to me, a fascinating aspect of what it's like to be a reporter in Chicago. Because I get the ringside seat, and that's why you're here, to get. We're doing it for you, too. So thanks to Rob Grant, and to my friend Jeff Carlin and co-host. Jeff is the executive producer of WGN's Rokon Show with Anna DeVolantis. And you know me, John Cass, husband, father, columnist, editorial board member of the Chicago Tribune. Find us on iTunes. Subscribe. Write us kick-ass reviews. And you know what? I'm not going to send you a bottle of champagne, but I will send you my thanks. Thanks for being here, and join us again next time for another edition of the Chicago Way.